Welcome to another episode of the Bakari Sellers Podcast. Well, I have two individuals on the show today who are just dynamic in their own right. One is a really, really good friend, and the other is an exceptional reporter. My good friend is Jay Martin. The exceptional reporter is Alex Burns. What's going on, guys? How are
He's
y'all
doing? He's
already
going negative. Like, first 10 seconds here. What is this?
I know. I want you to know that I've been working with a few folk from the Trump administration, Stephen Miller and others, to help prep for this interview.
Good friends of yours, I know.
How's the book tour going, guys? What's going on?
We're having a great time. We're in San Francisco, spending a few days on the West Coast. We're in Portland and Los Angeles. So if you're in Portland or Los Angeles, we're going to be in your community this week. Come out and see us, say hey, and we'll sign a book for you.
And June 23rd, we'll be in Charleston at Bucks and Books. But
yeah, we're going to Charleston, and I hopefully I'm trying to get a moderator for that event. But Carl, you know anybody?
Let's think that through. I'm thinking like Hootie. Mark Sanford. Let's do Mark Sanford. I'm serious. I'll call Mark. Mark's going to moderate our event.
Mark Sanford, Joe Riley, Hootie. Who else we got?
We don't need to have Joe Riley. I love Joe Riley, but we won't. I mean, by the time he finishes his remarks, it'll be time to go to Halls. Anyway, we know you, Jonathan. You've been on the show before, and you keep us on the loop in Twitter. Somebody needs to steal your Twitter sometimes. But Alex, this is your first time on the show. Talk to us about the arc of your career, starting with your time at the Harvard University on the Harvard Political Review to the work you're doing now at the New York Times. Walk us through the career stops in journalism from college to now.
I first worked with Jonathan. That was almost 15 years ago. And then moved over to the Time, worked at on the Metro desk at the paper and covering New York politics. And then right around 2015, New York politics kind of merged with national politics, thanks to Donald Trump and to a lesser extent, Chris Christie. And back on the national beat, I went. Jonathan and I started working on this book about 2 years ago. We've talked for years about doing a book together, but you know, it's a big undertaking, as you know. And we always sort of felt like if we're going to do a lift that heavy, we wanted to be on a campaign and at a political moment where it matters a lot and where it's really worth the blood, sweat, and tears. And in 2020, we felt like this was it.
Before we jump to the book, let's talk about current events really quickly. Should we expect anything from this White House on how we address white supremacist domestic terrorism? Because I think if we look at the Kyle Rittenhouse, the Dylann Roof, and now the Buffalo Massacre, we're starting to see, you know, the 4chan become mainstream politics and things that are parroted on Fox News, and you see candidates like or leadership like Congresswoman Stefanik. What will we see, and how will the White House be responding to this, do you guys think?
You know, President Biden speaking today in Buffalo, Bakari, I'm really curious to see his comments today and sort of how he goes forward on this topic. You know, obviously, he got into the campaign in the first place, he said, because Charlottesville and sort of white supremacist mob that rampages in Charlottesville sort of prompted him to come back to politics. Now, that may be more of a convenient origin story for what was Biden's third campaign for the presidency, but there's some truth to it. He obviously feels strongly about the issue. So I think he is well positioned to sort of take a stand on this. Now, substantively, what can you do as far as laws and regulations? I think it's a whole different story, but I think in terms of the bully pulpit, I mean, my goodness, if Joe Biden cannot use this as something to sort of grab onto and denounce and speak out about, I'm not sure who can.
So, Alex, let me ask you this. I mean, Dems are going to get shellacked in November, from what we tell, and not just because of the climate, but also because of redistricting. But how badly do you think Dems are going to do this summer and this fall? And is there anything that can be done, whether or not you're talking about white supremacist domestic terror or inflation or just Joe Manchin? I mean, what does the outlook look like, Alex?
Look, I think it's obviously really tough, particularly in the House. Some of that is redistricting. Some of it is just that the margin is so, so small to begin with that you would need like a world historic overperformance in the midterm in order to keep control of the chamber. But Bakari, you look at the Senate, you look at governor's races, and I think it's a much more a mixed picture. I think the environment's really, really tough for Democrats. But I think, if Republicans Do not lose this. If Republicans don't blow it in November, it will not be for lack of trying, right? The people they're putting up in some of these really big races are really, you know, some of them are really far out. Some of them have some very, very serious ethical and personal baggage attached to them. And so I think it's, you know, it's really easy to see a scenario where Democrats just get clobbered all the way up and down the ballot. I think it's also not that difficult to see a scenario where the House looks really tough, but where Republicans come up significantly short in a bunch of the big statewides because they nominate people who are not in the political mainstream. And I do think that that's where you know, the subject of your first question and second question kind of intersect a bit, where, you know, it's not that I think Americans are going to look at what happened in Buffalo and say that is, you know, my Republican congressman is responsible for that. But I do think that if Joe Biden is the, you know, if he is a messenger on a scale that the moment demands and sort of tries to draw the country back into a debate about what is politically mainstream and what is dangerous, there are obviously quite a few people in the Republican Party who have said and done things that put them in a space that I think the broad mainstream of American politics is not going to be comfortable with.
You know, this election cycle reminds me, and I think Donald Trump, the benefit of Trump to Democrats is it reminds me of Todd Akin and what's her name, who wasn't a witch?
Oh, Donald.
Christine O'Donnell.
Yeah. What is she doing now? Jay Mark, I mean, did she write a blurb for the book?
You know, I think she's opened up a very small sort of witchcraft operation in Salem.
In Salem, and, of all places.
Is working on some projects up there. I think there's a whole new perspective on witchcraft these days. I think folks are more open to it, you know?
Trust me, you never know. Let's talk.
Don't judge.
I'm the least judgmental person you'll ever meet. I'm friends with you. Let's talk about your new book, This Will Not Pass. So, Alex, J. Mark, why did you write it, and what do you want readers to take from it? And even more importantly, like, how did y'all know when to stop?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the how do you know when to stop question, we had that conversation probably once a week for, you know, all of calendar year 2021. Because, you know, we started out thinking that we were going to do a campaign book, then COVID hit. Then George Floyd was murdered. Then the insurrection happened. And it was just clear over and over and over again that like a campaign book is not going to be sufficient to capture this moment that we're in. We're going to want to cover the campaign, the transfer of power, and then, you know, get some real flavor of what happens next. But does that mean going through the American Rescue Plan? Does it mean going through, you know, whatever happens with infrastructure, Build Back Better? And where we landed was we would really like to see what happens with Build Back Better. We'd like to be able to say something more definitive about whether Joe Biden managed to not just beat Trump, but then really deliver on his promises from the campaign or not. And I think we kind of got in just under the wire that we were able to sort of capture the demise of Build Back Better last December. And you know, the point at which it became clear to us, and I think around the same time to the country as a whole, that yeah, Biden had managed to beat Trump. He had managed to get some real stuff done. But this idea that you were going to break the fever in the Republican Party and bring the country back to some version of normalcy, that clearly wasn't going to happen.
Why did you write this, J. Mark? And I read it.
Yeah.
I think it's a very well written book. So shout out to your ghostwriters. what do you want us to take from it?
This country has lived through and is still living through a political crisis that's unlike any in sort of modern times, that you have two parties that are having great difficulty in governing, that are sort of stretched to the limit in terms of trying to keep together their coalitions and trying to preside over a divided country, and especially with the Republican Party, are sort of facing extraordinary challenges in this moment, and increasingly are much less reminiscent of sort of traditional center-right American republicanism, and sort of closer to more of a nationalist type party of the sort that we see overseas. And I think it's important to sort of report that out and capture it as it happens. And Alex and I had never done a book before. We had read a lot of books, and we had obviously covered politics together for 15 years. And he and I were determined that we would put reporting first, and we would try to sort of get the most out of this moment. You know, we live in this sea of opinion and insight and takes, and sort of everybody and their uncle who has a Wi-Fi access can sort of like float what they think. What there's not a lot of is talking to people in both parties at the highest levels of government and trying to get at what are they doing and saying and thinking, Bakari, when the cameras are not on, and trying to convey that to people. What were your leaders doing in these tumultuous times behind the scenes? And I think with whether it's memos or notes or audio recordings, I think we capture this pivotal moment in American history in this book, which is called This Will Not Pass.
I don't know. Kyrsten Sinema says it's a gossip rag. How much of the 2022 midterms will be us still dealing with the remnants of the 2020 election? Are the midterms all about what happened in 2020, or is it a referendum on Joe Biden? What is it?
Look, I think it's both, but I think it's clear that because, you know, 2020 was more than anything a referendum on Donald Trump, and that one of the, you know, I think it's clear, it was clear-ish at the time. I think it's clear in retrospect that one of the big and wise strategic decisions that Biden made was to, you know, keep his own agenda relatively vague and a campaign in really broad strokes in terms of the promises that the American people really heard from him, and keep the focus on the fact that there was a president who was bungling a once-in-a-lifetime global health crisis and who was wildly offensive to a majority of the country. And, you know, on those terms, Biden did pretty well in that election. He's the first person to beat an incumbent president in a quarter century. But having said that, like, he's the president now, and it's sort of his turn under the hot lights. And, you know, I think more than anything else, what is dragging down Democrats at the moment is the sense that Joe Biden came into office promising to restore normalcy and to build back better. And we haven't even really built back, that, like, people don't feel good about their lives right now. And if we have a binary political system, it's really not that complicated, as you know, in most midterm elections. If you don't like how things are going, you either vote for the party that's already in power, or you vote for the other guy to register your discontent. And that seems to be what we're headed for right now.
This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori Clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Ready to find your next favorite podcast? Spotify makes it easier than ever to discover new favorites by previewing short audio clips before committing to a full listen. You can even watch some podcasts with video or just keep playing audio in the background. It's everything you want in one app. Music, podcasts, and audiobooks across any device. Play anytime, anywhere, any way you'd like with Spotify. Try today.
Can you talk a little bit about what you discovered in the book about the evolution of the relationship between Joe Biden and Kamala Harris? And do you think she's effectively being deployed by this White House? And if that answer is no, how much of that in through your research is because of the potential lingering issues between the Harris and Biden camps that may have followed them to the White House? I mean, I know the answer to some of this, but I just have to ask the question of people.
Yeah, no, Bakari, I think you know this better than anybody out there. That, you know, there's still tensions between the vice president's office and the West Wing that certainly stem from 2020. And I think that has never been fully resolved. And I think it's possible that it is never fully resolved. Look, I think she's trying to find her footing. She does not have deep experience in Washington. We report in the book that she's sort of reached out to some people who do have more experience in Washington, sort of trying to get advice as to the way forward, people that include Condoleezza Rice and Hillary Clinton, but also like Rahm Emanuel and Joe Scarborough. So she's trying to find her footing. And I think that obviously has created challenges. But I also think that what's fascinating about this book, and Alex and I talked a lot about this, is we understand the grumbling that is sort of out there about Vice President Harris. But what we want to do in this book, Bakari, is capture her perspective too, not just the West Wing is annoyed because of Vice President Harris fill in the blank, but also get at her perspective and her view as the first Black woman in this job and try to capture where her head's at. And I think that we do that pretty effectively.
How do you do it?
By sort of capturing a lot of the sort of conversations that she's having and sort of capturing her view of President Biden, occasionally her frustrations with Biden, certainly her frustrations with Biden's staff, and also sort of getting at her trying to figure out the job itself and what her role is going to be. We have a fascinating moment. Alex can jump in here and talk about it at length. But, you know, she had a breakfast with Angela Merkel that had a little bit of attention at the time. But we go a lot deeper on that conversation and sort of capture these two women who are grappling with, leading powerful countries in the West, and Merkel offering Kamala Harris some advice. But certainly Kamala Harris doing a lot more seeking of advice from Angela Merkel in that moment. And, I've been surprised that there's not more reporting about those kinds of conversations. And I think that's one of the things that we do in this book that makes it, I think, a pretty good read.
Yeah.
I
think there's a good reason why a lot of the reporting on the vice president so far has focused on the West Wing feeling like, you know, she's not certainly clearing the bar they would like her to clear. Right. I think they've made some pretty blunt and in many respects, valid criticisms. You know, we give you these assignments on the Northern Triangle and on other issues, and you sort of hold them at arm's length. They report in the book that she, you know, claims the voting rights portfolio, but then doesn't ever have a conversation with Joe Manchin or Lisa Murkowski about the voting rights issue. Those are two of the most important Senate votes on anything related to voting rights. But Bakar, the other side of it is that, look, and I think you have been as blunt as almost anybody in public about this. Biden put her on the ticket ostensibly, or he said, to make a big statement about the future of the country, the composition of the Democratic Party, and what he wanted his administration to stand for. And then it doesn't really seem like there was ever an intensive effort to follow through on the commitment that that selection represented, right? That if you're going to choose somebody as vice president who is not just another white guy who you can stick in the OEOB and forget about for 4 to 8 years, then surely there are some sort of other implied commitments there. I think one of the moments that really revealed just how fraught this is within the Democratic Party was when you spoke out and said that the White House had given her some trash assignments, and you got beaten up by the sort of pro-Harris wing of people because you were blunt about a reality that we all know to be the case.
Yeah. I mean, coming in and tackling voting rights and immigration as your portfolio, knowing that it's not going to pass, I think it's just somewhat of a dead end job. In writing this book, to kind of piggyback on that, what did you learn about the 2024 Democratic presidential field if Biden doesn't run? And how much do you think the midterms or these midterms will determine if he runs for re-election in 2024?
It's a great question, Bakari. And I think if Democrats do suffer really sort of deep losses, governorships, lose both the House and the Senate, I think you'll have Democrats who have sort of bitten their tongues, frankly, for the last year, stop biting their tongues and sort of say out loud that they're concerned about Biden's capacity to lead the party and sort of win the presidency again in 24. I think that's a conversation that you will see more out in the open if this midterm goes as bad as I know folks in your party fear it could. If it's not as bad, I think you'll see some restraint, and obviously folks will look back to 1996 and 2012 when Democratic presidents suffered midterm losses but still rebounded to win re-election. You know, I think there's a penalty within the parties and with, you know, both parties to sort of speak out and criticize your leader that's only gotten stronger. And I think with Democrats, that penalty is even more severe because the perception is that you're only helping Trump when you criticize your own side. But look, I think if this thing's a wipeout, I mean, I think there is more of a permission structure that lets Democrats speak out about their concerns on Biden, don't you?
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree. And some of us who don't care about that permission structure because our party is too old anyway.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln in the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh, my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates. This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else. This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear. Especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons.
Zooming out a bit after this book, I mean, one of the things that I realize is that, and one of my takeaways is that the two-party system is really a part of the problem of why our democracy is broken. And I think this book underscores how fragile democracy is. Is that one of the themes that you all intentionally kind of laid out, or is it just something that one will deduce from reading this book?
No, I think that's a great way of put it. I mean, the notion that democracy is on relatively thin ice.
I mean, you can use that as you travel. Yeah. I mean, you don't have to attribute that to me.
Like, we certainly believe that to be true, right? That the fractiousness of our system, the internal divisions are just so crippling at this point in a way that goes beyond at least our political culture of the last few decades. You know, we've had darker moments in our history than this one, but it's a pretty bad point right now. Your point about the two-party system itself being part of the problem, I think we totally agree with that. I think we don't draw it out quite as much in the book as we might have. But, you know, one senior Democratic member of Congress we interviewed, and I don't think we actually ended up using this quote, was saying that, look, if the Democratic Party were in a European country, it would be like six or seven different parties, right? And that's clearly true, right? You would have your socialists over here, your Greens over here, your sort of free market liberals over here, and every
your conservative Dems,
yeah, exactly. Your labor with a U, and every couple of years you would piece together like a coalition government. And by the way, you'd probably have some people who are currently Republicans, but who you would induce to join
anti-Trumpers.
Yeah,
anti-Trumpers.
You would have sort of the Liz Cheney breakaway faction in your coalition, and she would be the minister of the interior or something like that. But we don't have that kind of system. It's just not that dynamic. You have a one choice on the left, a one choice on the right. And the left, by the way, is everything from Joe Manchin to Bernie Sanders. And the right is everything from, Adam Kinzinger to Marjorie Taylor Greene, right? And that is a really hard way to do business. But, you know, it's also a hard thing to talk. You know, we've as long as we've been political reporters, every 4 years, except, I guess, for 2020. No, because there was Howard Schultz. Every 4 years, somebody floats like the two-party system is the problem. We should find another way out of it. And there's just no escaping it. And it's a giant, giant handicap.
So you mentioned a name. Can you talk a little bit about Joe Manchin and his relationship with the White House here? Because he makes a few cameos in the book, and he's played such a vital role in undermining this White House and Democratic priorities to date. Talk about the evolution of the relationship between Manchin and Biden detailed in the book, and how close was Manchin to leaving the party altogether?
Yeah, so we captured this remarkable scene, Bakari, soon after Biden was sworn into the presidency in 2021, where I think some of your listeners will recall this, Vice President Harris did a series of interviews, including some in West Virginia, sort of gently pushing Manchin to support the American Rescue Plan. Manchin was really ticked off about that. And I think he expressed that publicly. Well, privately in those weeks, a few Senate Republicans had dinner with him and used that dinner on Capitol Hill to really push him to change parties. And he sort of gave a classic Joe Manchin response when John Thune pushed him. He said, well, John, if you were the Senate Republican leader, I would do it, which is a sort of, you know, way that he's bullshitting with John Thune a little bit. And I think the Republicans realized that it was probably a long shot at that point. So I'm not sure he was ever close to leaving the party, but just that opening, the fact that he can do it tomorrow, that gun's always loaded, Bakari, I think is very powerful. And obviously it sort of creates challenges for Democrats. He can control the agenda to a great degree. And I don't totally understand why, when he was difficult in the final days of passing the American Rescue Plan in 2021, why the White House didn't realize that they would have to sort of be much more mindful of his priorities and sort of doing what he wanted to do later that year on Build Back Better. I mean, clearly he was reluctant to sort of do too much, but he was open. He put it on paper and gave Chuck Schumer a letter about what he would do on Build Back Better. And I'm just not sure why the White House wouldn't sort of take that as a bird in hand at the time, because obviously once the fall came around, he was looking for any reason not to support the sort of big expansive proposal known as Build Back Better. It was inflation one day, and then it became the war in Ukraine, and now it's mid-May, and here we are, and the thing is out of standstill.
I can't wait to see who writes the book, President Manchin. I think that's going to be like a tracing his relationship with Nick Saban through.
But this is the whole thing, Bakari, is like
West Virginia.
He, you know, we asked some folks about it, like, you know, can't you try to work Manchin and sort of take care of his state? And what's striking about Manchin is that, unlike, you know, Robert Byrd, for example, he's not somebody who will just sort of take a massive amount of pork for, you know, a bridge or a highway in his state and call it a day. He's totally, dedicated to bipartisanship for the sake of bipartisanship. And he didn't like legislation that was not bipartisan, and he would always push back against it.
He just doesn't have the policy depth, but that's a whole nother story. How can folks find the book, and how can they follow you both on social media? And guys, I will tell you, the book is not all doom and gloom. A good portion of it is, but it's not all doom and gloom. It actually has some great antidotes in there. But how can people find the book and follow you both on social media?
Well, the book is called This Will Not Pass: Trump, Biden, and the Battle for America's Future. It is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and hopefully in your local independent bookstore as well. If you are in a position to pick it up from an independent bookseller, we both strongly encourage you to do so. I'm on Twitter at AlexBurnsNYT, all one word.
And I'm JMartNYT on Twitter. We'd be grateful if your audience would pick up a copy of This Will Not Pass. There's a lot of reporting in there. And frankly, if you heard about the book and sort of seen some snippets or heard the McCarthy audio, there's a lot more beyond that you're going to be really fascinated.
It's a fascinating book for political junkies, people who fear democracy is slipping, people who love Trump, people who hate Trump, people who are trying to figure out what the hell this Democratic Party is doing. Thank you both for joining us. It was a privilege to have you guys. I'll see you with one or both of them on June 23rd. And also check them out while they're on the road. They're actually, it's the first wave of authors that are able to do actual in-person events. So shout out to you all. Enjoy, guys. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bakari. Appreciate it, man.
All right. Thanks, Alex. Be safe, guys.
This episode is brought to you by Empower. You got money questions like, can I retire early? What are my best savings options? Can I afford to pay for my kids' education? Luckily, Empower has all the answers. With Empower's real-time dashboard and real live conversations, you get clarity on your real-life financial goals. So join 18 million Americans and Empower What's Next. Start today at empower.com. tap the banner or visit this episode's page to learn more. Sponsored by Empower, not an endorsement or a statement of satisfaction by a client. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.